Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're very pleased to have Michaela Honecke on the show, and we'll be talking about her new book, Know Your Enemy, American Debate on Nazism, 1933 to 1945. Most Americans know something about World War II. They know we fought the Germans and the Japanese, and most Americans, I think, probably have the impression that we, in the German case, thought the Nazis were very bad actors, and that having realized this, we went across the pond to save the Germans from Hitler and his crew. Anyone who believes this should read this book because it is a mistaken impression. It turns out that there were lots of Americans in Germany who did realize that the Nazis were, in fact, bad actors from the beginning, and they informed Roosevelt about it. But many of them also argued, as I think many historians do today, that there was very widespread German support for the Nazis, that there was something of a kinship between something in the German soul and Hitler. You don't want to take this kind of thing too far, but it's fascinating to read about what Americans said about the Nazis from 33 to the beginning of the war. And then after the war, there are also some very interesting things that Michaela has to say about the American reception of the news about the Holocaust and also post-war plans concerning the disposition of Germany. There are lots of myths that are busted in Know Your Enemy. I should also add that the book is wonderfully written. Why is it so often the case that people that are not native English speakers write such beautiful English prose? This book is written in a very crisp style that I think should be widely emulated, and Cambridge University Press should be congratulated for publishing it. As you can see, I enjoyed the book, and I enjoyed talking to Michaela today. I hope that you enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Michaela.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm very well. Michaela, you're right down the hall from me, aren't you?
I am.
So if I were to ask you about the weather,
Looking at the same weather,
we're
right?
We're looking at the same weather, yeah. So those of you who listen to this program a lot know that we follow the weather in Iowa very closely, and I believe Michaela will agree with me that today is a very beautiful day.
Yeah, blue sky and sun, and one couldn't ask for more.
No, very crisp, very wonderful. I should tell our listeners that we have Michaela Honecke on the show today, and we'll be talking about her new book, Know Your Enemy, American Debate on Nazism, 1933 to 1945. It's just come out. We debated this a little bit. We think that it has just come out from Cambridge University Press. I have read the book, and I think it's absolutely terrific. I hope that it is widely read. I really do, because it's one of these books that clears up a lot of misconceptions about what Americans thought about Nazism before the war, after 33, and then all the way up to the point at which they were debating what the heck to do about the Nazis in Germany after the war. And I really think anybody who is interested in World War II or Nazism or Franklin Roosevelt or any of these characters should give the book a close read. And so it was my great pleasure to read it. Michaela, why don't you begin by telling us just a little bit about yourself? I always use this word in the interviews, and people don't understand it. Give us your Lebenslauf.
Okay, I can do that. I do understand that word. Well, Marshall, I think that, you know, our listeners should also know that this is the morning after Thanksgiving, and I think that that shows your real dedication to scholarship that we're having this interview on this day.
Well,
I really very much appreciate that. Well, about myself, I'm an assistant professor at the University of Iowa in the History Department, where I teach the history of American foreign relations and transatlantic relations. And I had, I guess, a variety of teaching positions and other positions before I came here almost 2 years ago now. I started really teaching history at the Kennedy Institute, at the Free University in Berlin, where I taught also mainly American history. And then after that, I worked for the German Council on Foreign Relations, which is a Berlin-based foreign policy think tank. And then I moved back to the United States, where earlier I had done my graduate training in at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. So I moved back to my alma mater as a DAD professor. That's the abbreviation for the German Academic Exchange Service. And in Chapel Hill in North Carolina. I taught again, mainly German history, actually. German history, European transatlantic relations. And then from there, I moved to Canada, and at York University in Toronto, I taught American foreign policy again. So I think of my previous teaching positions as having this pattern that I either teach, prior to Iowa at least, I teach American history, foreign policy in particular to non-Americans, and I teach German history and European history to non-Germans. That pattern really only dissolved when I came here in Iowa.
I was going to say, let me ask you how you became interested in America.
Well, I think that's sort of in my case, that's a family inheritance, especially on the side of my father. So I was born in Germany. I grew up in Germany. And my father really has a lifelong fascination, I think, admiration with this country. He worked for General Motors, so my family lived in Detroit at times, first when I was a child.
Really?
And then, in the mid-80s, my family, without me, moved back and lived just outside Detroit for 2 years. And then when they moved back to Germany, I actually began my graduate studies in North Carolina. And I think that even though there is, you know, this generational difference, obviously, between my father and me, that for both of us, the United States has been sort of the land of opportunity, not necessarily in a material sense, although it worked out career-wise, I think, for both of us, but with regard to identity issues. In particular, when I was young, I really felt a strong urge to escape my German identity, and I first tried that when it was done with high school in Germany. I moved to Paris. I began my university studies in Paris, and I sort of wanted to become French. And I think that I made some headway and some success. I spoke French very well. I had a really nice Parisian accent. And then, you know, one day I was watching Casablanca with my French friends. And in the discussion after the film, which I had seen so many times, like, you know, all of us, and I always identified with, you know, Bogart as well as Ingrid Bergman. In the discussion with my Parisian friends afterwards, I realized that I couldn't really play on the other side. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I had to be the German in this discussion. I mean, in Paris, I had to be the German. I couldn't, like, switch over, you know, and become one of the allies. And I always found the United States and, you know, my American colleagues and friends much more accommodating. You know, I think you can be whoever you want to be, and whichever way you want to sort of shape your identity here. So in that sense, I think it was both for my father and Mia, the land of opportunity.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, I know a lot of Germans in the United States, and they seem to assimilate very, very well. I know a lot of Russians in the United States, and oftentimes they don't assimilate as well. I don't know exactly why that is. And I spent some time in Germany, and I found it a kind of a strange place, to be honest with you, but also a familiar place in another way. So I sort of understand. And I've had a lifelong fascination with Germany myself, even though I'm a Russian historian. And I was very happy to be able to go over there and spend some time, thanks to the Deutsche Akademische Austauschdienst.
Mm-hmm.
Give them a plug. Those people are very good. I always tell my graduates, if you want to learn a language and you want to learn it for free, you should try German because they'll pay you to learn German.
I'm glad to hear that because, I think, you know, they're very committed and they deserve to get some advertisements.
Oh, no, they totally do. They paid for me to have a trip over there, and any undergraduate or graduate student that wants to go and learn German, they basically will pay you a stipend to go do it. So it's an absolutely terrific organization. So how did you come to write this book about American perceptions of the Nazis from 33 to 45?
Well, you know, that also has to do, obviously, with my background, but goes back, I think, even further. I think that, like many Germans of my generation, I had, as a teenager, I had quite a preoccupation with the Third Reich. So in high school, I would write papers on sort of the collapse of the Weimar Republic, you know, the years leading up to the nightmare years, the sort of sense of impending doom, or on, you know, exile authors and artists and immigrants later. I was really interested in the German resistance. So I think that I always, I had this obsession with the Third Reich, but I often pursued it sort of from the periphery. But I think that as a child, I was already quite aware that sort of at the center of the history of my country was this place of horror, and that I couldn't really, but I had to keep looking at it, you know, that I couldn't really turn away from it. And then coming to this country as a graduate student, I think in some ways you could describe this book, which is based on my dissertation, as another attempt to approach the and explore the Third Reich from the periphery, right, from the outside. This time sort of me looking at the Americans, looking at the Nazis. So in some ways it's a continuation of really a longstanding preoccupation. I think also when I applied for a fellowship, a Fulbright fellowship, to come to study in this country, I really wanted to study in Chapel Hill, and I made a case for wanting to do something about Southern history, because I thought that way, you know, they would make sure that they sent me to North Carolina, which is really where I wanted to go. But actually, I wanted to work with, you know, this man whom I didn't know personally at the time, who became my mentor, Gerhard Weinberg. And I think that in many ways, I mean, I think that my two big mentors, Gerhard Weinberg and Michael Hunt, also really sort of shaped the outline of this project in the end. You know, Gerhard is one of the really the leading authority on World War II and Nazi foreign policy and other aspects of the Third Reich. And he and his immediate family escaped Nazi Germany in 38 as German Jews. And sometimes I think I can't even like fully grasp the extent of the impact that this man had on me. But then on the other hand, you know, the second teacher, Michael Hunt, who's really the model historian in my field of American foreign policy. So I think the Nazi German aspect and the foreign policy aspect, you know, was represented in, you know, with these teachers, and that really guided me also.
And what had been written about American perceptions of the Nazis between 33 and 45 before you wrote this book?
I think it was all very fragmented and only looking at specific aspects of the topic. I think that if you look at the sort of at the entire historiography, what really predominates is the Holocaust and how it was misunderstood or not understood, and sort of the American response to the Holocaust. I think especially from the 1980s on, that that becomes a sort of a dominant theme in the American historiography. And I'm deeply indebted to that literature, but reading it, it always seemed to me that there was part of the story missing, you know, because these people looked at, you know, who knew what in the United States at what time, and what were the reasons why they responded or did not respond in this way. And I thought, well, clearly there is a larger, right, both governmental and but especially public debate going on, and that story really needs to be told. Maybe prior to the 80s and 90s, with, you know, an emphasis sort of on the American response to the Holocaust, the literature was dominated by you know, post-war plans. So, you know, were the Germans treated fairly in the, you know, the American wartime debate, and did the American government have a coherent and constructive plan, you know, for what to do with Germany after the war? And again, I'm very indebted to that literature, but it seemed to me that part of that was, I mean, there was also something missing there. Some of that literature really like hardly acknowledges the war and what the Germans did in the war, and sort of starts with 45 and post 45, and centers on all the mistakes that the Americans made before they got something wrong. And I thought, no, wait a minute, there is a really important prehistory to, you know, to these developments.
Mm-hmm. And it's a fascinating prehistory too. Let's talk a little bit about the first section of the book, which was a huge surprise to me, and I bet a surprise to everyone else. Franklin Delano Roosevelt spent some time in Germany. I did not know this.
Yeah,
and you begin
yeah.
by talking about his understanding of Germany even before 1933. So
yeah.
go ahead and talk a little bit about him.
Yeah, so he, I think he was quite representative sort of his class and his time in that, you know, his parents would just regularly, you know, on an annual basis take these trips to Europe. And then the father had a preference for some spas, Bad Nauheim in Germany. So, you know, Roosevelt spent several, you know, the summers over the course of several years in Germany, had German friends. There are letters that he writes back home as a child to his cousins, you know, talking about his adventures in Germany. And then he is put into school there, I think, in the end, probably only for one summer, you know, for a couple of weeks, mainly possibly reconnects with some of those friends that he makes there in the following summer. But later, as a wartime president, he claims that, you know, he went to school in Germany for an extended time, and sort of he traces the militarization of Germany over the course of several years where he went to school there. And he remembers that part wrongly, I think, you know.
Yeah.
Having looked at the papers in Hyde Park, you know, there is only and also the diary of his mother, there is only evidence for one summer really. But so he had some direct and personal experience, but and he makes use of that when he wants to argue against some of his sort of key advisors, especially Hull, during the wartime debate. I argue that these childhood memories really get filled more substantially with his experience of being part of the Wilson cabinet in World War One. You know, I think that the World War One experience was formative, really, for his generation, you know, and thereby for many other of his cabinet members, you know, during World War Two.
And how was it? I'm sorry. How was it formative?
Well, I think this is where Germany really emerges as the enemy, and where this particular understanding that, you know, Germany is a militaristic or inherently aggressive nation emerges. I think that emerges for the first time in World War One. Sort of an essentialized enemy images, an essentialized enemy image. And I think for some people that survives or is revived, you know, in World War Two. I think what's important about Roosevelt specifically is that both during the war and then afterwards in the historical literature, he is accused of having this essentialized understanding of Germany, right? That this enemy image that he basically forms in World War One just continues for him, and that he, Kennan says, you know, George F. Kennan says about Roosevelt, he never really understood the difference between the German Empire, Imperial Wilhelmine Germany of World War One, and then Nazi Germany. And I would argue that that's not true. He understood the difference very well. I think that Roosevelt's mind worked in such a way that, you know, he looked at things as if they were sort of a stamp collection, like everything was two-dimensional and he could put it, you know, one thing next to another. So I don't think he developed a coherent theory of the German national character. And he was very open to new information. And he was very well, you know, he had access to many sources, but also really kept an open mind starting in 1933. He was well supplied with, you know, new information about what was going on in this new Germany. Mm-hmm. And I think he welded that into a new and updated understanding of how sort of Nazi Germany was different from previous incarnations of German Empire.
I just wanted to break in and say that I've been doing some reading about American impressions of Germany and Germans at the end of the 19th century and before the war in the early 20th century, and they're very favorable. Especially what we might call the cultural or educational elite. There was even something called the German method or German system, and it had great fans in American higher education at the end of the 19th and early 20th centuries. Many people don't know this, but it was hotly debated, and the debate was basically between people that liked the German system, which included graduate school, and people that did not, who were rather sort of stuck in the 19th century. The German system won out, by the way, and for those of you who have gone to an American university, you are now subject to the German system.
Not just to, German-born professors, but to an entire German system.
Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah, no, yes, we have a German system here now. And then, of course, there were, even now, I think it's funny to go into one of our classes. I did this recently here in Iowa, and I ask how many of my students – I ask just the question, how many of you are German, just like that?
Mm-hmm.
And a good – over half of them opened their hand. Or raise their hands. And I think, what is it? It's like 6 in 10, I don't know what the proportion is, but 6 in 10 Americans or something claim German descent. And I have German descent myself. I know this for a fact. My people came over in the early 19th century to Ohio, and they had a very favorable attitude. And it's funny, I interviewed a fellow who wrote a book about Jewish immigrants to New York. And it's clear the New Yorkers preferred the Germans to almost anybody else. They really wanted the Germans to come, and the German Jews were fine too. It was the other people that they didn't particularly like. So it's interesting how this changed during World War One so very quickly.
But it seems then that World War One and the sort of the anti-German hysteria, it always struck me as an aberration to this larger story that you just began sketching. I think that in general there is, as you say, a much more positive attitude. And there is always that reference to, German immigration. But if you look at the numbers, and then you look at the numbers in World War II or in the 30s and in the 40s of, Americans expressing, empathy with the Germans or some kind of ethnic cultural affinity, I think that those numbers go far beyond just sort of German American immigrants. You know what I mean? I think that there is an ethnic cultural affinity that goes beyond this idea that, my grandfather emigrated or came to this country, or we're direct descendants, in some form from Germany. I think that there is this study that analyzes the image of Germans in literature, but especially in textbooks around 1900, and that historian comes to a very good conclusion. She says that Americans basically highlighted features in the Germans, ingenuity, cleanliness, efficiency, that they really liked in themselves. So they look at the Germans and they see something that they really like about themselves or would like, to see in their own society.
It's funny because if you look at the British understanding of the Germans at the end of the 19th and early 20th century, there's a kind of conflation, and one sees this particularly with Churchill, who, by the way, was not open to new ideas. He saw all Germans as Prussians, and I don't think most Americans would even know what a Prussian was in 1920 or 1910. But it's the Prussians that were the problem, and they were militaristic. You see, that was the deal, and he grew up on that. That was sort of his mother's milk, and he never forgot it. He always conflated Germans and Prussians, and I don't think Americans had any understanding of what Prussia was.
Well, I think to a certain extent they did, Marshall, at least sort of in elite circles, like people who would be reading, the Journal of the Nation or so on. I think that Prussia moves a little bit to the center of American sort of political elite awareness after the Civil War in this country, because people draw parallels between German unification, of which we're now so critical, right? It's under Bismarck, and after three wars, kicking out the Austrians, kicking out the Danish and defeating the French. So today I think this congeals for us into this, inherently militaristic, empire that's about to emerge. But if you look at the literature at the time and sort of, highbrow magazines, there is a real appreciation of Prussia, and again, the sense that they are similar to what we were doing here, especially the North, right? That would be the identification. Mm-hmm. It's a unification, you know, of a modern, progressive, forward-looking central state.
I didn't know that. That's fascinating. Mm-hmm. I've read mostly about the impact of this Prussian image on the on the English understanding of Germany,
yeah.
and it was very considerable in the conservative conservative side of British politics. But let's go on to talk about some of FDR's correspondence in Germany, some of the people that wrote him about Germany after 33. And the thing I came away from your book understanding is that many of them got it quite right. That they were writer than many of us are.
I mean, that was one of the big rewards of doing this research. You know, that I it was really an avenue for me to go back to looking at the Third Reich, and I was very favorably surprised that really the depth and the breadth of the sophistication in many ways, the accuracy and the sophistication of the contemporary understanding. I think much of that is based on really excellent reporting by foreign correspondents. You know, there is a historian who writes on intelligence in World War II, and he says about the American case, you know, we didn't really have that much intelligence, and we didn't really have intelligence agencies yet at that time. But the foreign correspondents were really quite amazing. You know, they had contacts in high circles, but they also at the same time really, you know, they lived among the Germans, so you know they were very open to. To how the sort of the variety of German responses to their new leadership, you know, the level of support and difference and so on. So I think the American foreign correspondents in Germany later in Central Europe really deserve a lot of credit. And, you know, some of them wrote directly to Roosevelt. Roosevelt, moreover, had friends who were businessmen and still had business interests in Nazi Germany and would go back and then also again talk to, you know, people from all walks of life in Germany. So he got he was very eager and interested in that and invited that and encouraged people to, you know, he thanked them for having written this 5-page, you know, single-spaced report mm-hmm. on, you know, Germany in 36, and said, please write again. So he had access to a wide range of assessments of what was going on in Nazi Germany. He was, I would stress his open-mindedness, because it's striking when you go through his papers that he did not only encourage people to write to him who were reporting to him what he sort of, you know, was thinking about Nazi Germany, but he also encouraged Joseph Kennedy, you know, to keep the flow of information going. And Kennedy, who was an appeaser, did not really, you know, represent a political assessment that Roosevelt shared. But he wanted to sort of have the entire panorama. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about some of these people. One of them that I was interested in was, I think his name's William Dodd. Is that right? William?
Yeah, that's the ambassador.
Yeah. I've actually, in another weird connection, I've read some of his letters from Germany to FDR, and they are 5-page single-spaced.
Yeah.
Really very beautifully written, detailed analysis that get, you know, his Dodd's own understanding evolves, but he's pretty much, as we would say, on the money about the Nazis.
Yeah. That's right. I think also it's I'm always reminded what I think that both for the journalists and for the ambassador and for other people, Americans working in the German embassy, in the American embassy in Berlin, I think that they sensed from the beginning, from 1933 on, that this might turn into quite an existential question, but it was absolutely necessary to get the story right, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, this is why I chose this title for the book, which come sort of straight out of the sources. There was really that imperative to know your enemy, you know, even though in 33 it was only clear to a minority that this, you know, that this was going to be an enemy in a formal sense, you know. Dodd, but especially someone who worked under him, Messerschmitt, and then again, you know, journalists would write as early as 33 or 34, Nazism means war, you know. There is the fascinating story of the publication of Hitler's Mein Kampf, you know, his first book, in this country. And it's available in 33. And, again, the president writes in a handwritten note to Houghton Mifflin, which is the company that first publishes, an English translation of Mein Kampf. So the president, in a handwritten note to Houghton Mifflin, says, you know, thank you for sending this copy to me. But I would like to point out to you that this is a rather expurgated version. And, the German original would make for quite a different story. And he highlights in particular two things. One is, the really intense commitment to a murderous anti-Semitism. And the other one is the foreign policy aims, which are, you know, much more the war aims later of the, of the Germans, which are much more excessive. And, so some people again point to that and say, you see, Roosevelt went to school in Germany and he knew German, and, you know, I don't think that he knew German, and I don't think that, you know, he had read the, you know, Mein Kampf in the original. But again, his connections to people who did know German and who had read Mein Kampf. So there is quite a campaign headed by some of these foreign correspondents to get a more complete and accurate translation of Mein Kampf out, which eventually happens later in the 1930s.
I can tell you that, and this is probably typical of people of my background and generation, my introduction to German history in general and then the Third Reich was reading Rise and Fall of the Third Reich by William, and I don't have any idea how to pronounce his last name,
Shirer, I would say.
Can you talk a little bit about him? Because that book was, I think, incredibly influential. I remember it even to this day. It was one of the only books my parents had in the house. I don't know why.
Right. Yeah.
No, but that, I read it. Yeah.
That sounds right to me. I mean, to this day, you know, students come to me and that's the book that they have read, you know, and I'm happy to work with that because he is you know, part of that group of, you know, very conscientious and well-informed journalists. What I noticed looking at his diary, which, you know, is now also published, or which for a long time has been published now in two parts.
Is this called the Nightmare Years, or is it what's it
no,
called?
No, that's a memoir.
Oh,
I think that
okay.
his diaries from the time, you know, which would have like entries of November 38 and so on, was, you know, sort of his 30s and then his wartime diary, but it comes out during the war. Anyways, his diary shows a much greater ambivalence about the Germans than his post-war writing. You know, so in some ways we have this phenomenon that after the war, you know, at least for some people, the enemy image does congeal, right? And you know, Shirer would look back and think, well, this, you know, this was sort of inevitable, and you know, there is an inherently aggressive, militaristic streak. We find him much more ambivalent about the Germans in the 30s when he lives among them. His wife is Austrian, an Austrian artist, and he will say things like, you know, taken individually, the Germans are just like you and me. They're, you know, they're a decent human beings, but something seems to happen to them, you know, when they get into this collective, and then the brainwashing seems to work on them, and then they don't have any sort of inner political cultural resistance against this authoritarianism and then, you know, racism and excessive nationalism. So it's easy for the Nazis to manipulate and to brainwash them and to meld them, to weld them into an instrument of their aggressive policy. I would say that in general, what I found remarkable is that, you know, I'm highlighting in the book four different journalists, but, you know, altogether, I mean, I could have written about 20 or 30 of them, and they are all quite remarkable. But I chose those four because I think they were the most widely read at the time. You know, they had, you know, weekly columns, and they were the most important so foreign correspondents. Shira, for example, spoke regularly on the radio, so many people would have heard his broadcast. They come up with, in the end, really conflicting interpretations of Nazi Germany. You know, conflicting interpretations of, you know, what that country is about and what it means, if it means inevitably war, how central the racism, you know, the anti-Semitism is. And then I think most importantly, they come up with conflicting interpretations about really the status of the German people, you know, the level of popular support for different aspects of Nazi policy, you know, domestic as well as then increasingly foreign policy, war, you know. And I think that that means for Americans back home that they can sort of, you know, pick and choose and take, you know, from this larger menu, this variety of interpretation, those that make sense to them. I think that's a very important contributing factor why there is no coherent enemy image, you know, as we had for the Germans in World War I, or as we have for the Japanese in World War II.
Because really, the way I understood the debate to be framed, on the one side, people said that Nazism was a sort of, I think as you put it in the book, it's either a disease or it's led by gangsters. And then there were people like Shirer, I think, who said that it had deeper German roots, that in fact the Germans really did support Hitler and were really behind him, as Hitler himself said, I think.
So
it really was difficult to tell which was the case.
Well, you know, when I sort of look at the sources in detail, I find that they sort of anticipate and foreshadow many of the more carefully studied conclusions to which historians came in the 60 years, you know, 70 years since. And I find that aspect in particular quite fascinating, you know, and I can only explain it with this, that people felt a great urgency, you know, to get the story right. That was, I think, one attraction of the disease, of the medical, you know, metaphor. You know, it was sort of this, the case history, you know, first the case history of the, you know, of German history had to be, of the German patient had to be laid out and explained. And then from that, you had to come to the right conclusion, which was, you know, the diagnosis of what was wrong with these people. You know, was it the Versailles Treaty, which had been, you know, maybe too harsh, you know, or was it were there deeper roots in German political culture and history? And then from the diagnosis, the cure, you know, like what, you know, so I mean, how can we help these people and help ourselves and prevent World War III? You know, what foundations do we need to lay in order to facilitate pacification and liberalization and democratization after the war? So since you brought up Shira, I mean, what he, I think, comes to represent in the end is what at the time during World War II was called the Vansittart position. You know, Lord Vansittart was a British politician who wrote a couple of books on Germany that were very useful for wartime anti-German propaganda. Like, you know, one was called The Black Record, namely the black record really of the German people. And I think the Vansittart position, which was much maligned in this country, in the United States at the time, it was compared to that's really sort of a racist conception of the Germans. That's not much better than how the Nazis think about the Jews. Which was really a horrible comparison to make, you know, but people, you know, this comes up all the time. But the Vansittart position, I argue in my book, even though it was in part a wartime polemic, in its descriptive and analytical parts, gets the story of the Third Reich much better, much more accurate than those Americans who tried to defend, you know, German, either the German people or, you know, German culture. So the core aspects of this Vincititus position is to argue that there actually is a lot of support among the German people for different aspects of Nazi policy. Mm-hmm. You know, not every German was ready to murder a Jew personally, but, you know, there was just enough support for anti-Semitic policy or indifference or acquiescence or, you know, Germans actually benefiting from that policy, or Germans being just sort of nationalistic enough, you know, not to want to criticize this government that had so successfully revised, you know, the Versailles Treaty. Mm-hmm. I think the level of support is what they get right. And thereby really overriding a widespread phenomenon of in this country of distinguishing between the German people and the Nazi gangsters and the Nazi government, mm-hmm. sort of drawing a sharp contrast and dichotomy between those two. Mm-hmm. And then there was also in this country during the war a discourse about the other Germany, you know, that there was this other Germany which is cultured and peaceful, and, you know, look at the immigrants and refugees in this country and so on. And again, the Vincititus says, yeah, there is this other Germany, but we don't think that they are sort of the liberal Germany, the good Germany, mm-hmm. but we don't think that they are very effective. Mm-hmm. I mean, they had, they had the entire period of the Weimar Republic, and they were not able to stay the course or to defend democracy or, you know, liberalism in that country. Mm-hmm. So the different elements of this much more critical Vincititist position in the end amount to what in the internationalized historiography on Germany becomes the special path paradigm. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that German history took a special path. Especially after 1870-71, mm-hmm. you know, after unification. And that really draws on a cherished German self-image from around 1900, where German elites promote that idea and self-consciously say, yeah, we, you know, German civilization took a different path than, you know, than Western civilization, than the French, the British, and the Americans. So the origins of that is actually a proud understanding of that special path. And I think during the war, the Vincititists remodeled that into an indictment of mm-hmm. German history and German culture.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you this: what did if we can tell? You talk about it a little bit in the book. What did a sort of everyday Americans? One's always skeptical of any general statement about the common man or the man on the street.
Yeah.
Let's try it anyway. What did the man on the street or the woman on the street in the United States think about Nazi Germany immediately before and at the beginning of the war, let's say? And what did the Roosevelt administration do to mobilize what we might call American antipathy toward the Nazis in order to fight the war?
Yeah, so I think that there are two maybe countervailing phenomena there for this entire period between 33 and sort of through the Great Debate, you know, 39, 40, 41, all the way up to Pearl Harbor. And that is on the one hand what we already talked about, the very detailed and accurate reporting, which also feeds, an anti-Nazi movement, in this country and sort of an awareness of what's going on. The counterpart to that is, a great skepticism and disbelief of the accuracy of that reporting. And I think that is fed by different sources. I mean, there is this sort of lingering empathy with the Germans. There is a kind of hangover from World War I, from the anti-German hysteria. There is a backlash, I think, against World War I in so many ways. The atrocity propaganda, in the beginning of World War I, the sort of overheated domestic anti-German propaganda in this country. But there's also a backlash against Wilsonianism, and I think that becomes quite important during the 30s and sort of merges with the fact that, again, there is a Democratic president in the White House. And again, it seems like he's about to lead the country into war, just as Wilson had done. So there's a backlash, I think, against Wilsonianism, sort of military liberal interventionism, if that makes sense, you know, to make the world safe for democracy. Mm-hmm. So I think Americans debate rather critically, well, I mean, even if horrible things are going on in Nazi Germany, what's the relevance of that to us? Mm-hmm. Why do we have to fight again? We tried this before and it didn't work out, you know. So let's not do that again. The public opinion polls, I think, more specifically, show that there is always pretty much a majority of Americans who are just not ready to hate or fear the Germans. Mm-hmm. And I think the underlying reason for that is this understanding that we talked about at the beginning of the hour. The Germans are like us, you know. So maybe they got captured temporarily by the Nazis, you know, imagined as a gangster government mm-hmm. that sort of apparently descended on Germany from outer space, you know, since they were Martians. They had landed there, and now the Germans maybe became even the first victims of Nazi aggression. You know, some people put the story together that way. So that the war propagandists become quite despairing, even in the middle of the war, and say, you know, we really ought to do something to instill a little bit more fear and hatred in our people, you know, of the German people. Mm-hmm. But the Office of War Information, which is our propaganda agency, you know, at the time, chooses, I think, a deliberate policy of restraint. I mean, perhaps even at a higher level, Roosevelt, you know, opts for sort of deliberately restrained propaganda policy. And then the Office of War Information, I think you could say, studies too closely these public opinion polls, even during the war, that show this sort of ethnic identification with the German people, and then constructs a wartime image of the Germans that builds on that. Mm-hmm. And accommodates two things, this sort of ethnic empathy, ethnic cultural solidarity with the Germans, but also in more sort of political, ideological terms, I think that American liberalism implies a distinction between people and government. And mm-hmm. I think you see that not only in the German case or in World War II, but you find that throughout America's war mobilizations or understanding of other people, you know, a distinction between government and people, and government you know, militaristic leaders, they might be aggressive, but really what the people are usually understood to be inherently peaceful and, you know, all wanting the same thing, which is freedom and democracy. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, one of my favorite foreign correspondents at the time is Dorothy Thompson. Mm-hmm. And she's such a multifaceted.
Yes, she's very interesting person.
Very interesting. And she's politically a conservative. And she writes, you know, at the time, that is a big liberal fallacy. You know, people do not always want freedom, and certainly not always democracy, because democracy is actually sort of difficult. Populism is much easier. Yeah. And I think this conclusion to which she comes is it's not so much because she is a conservative, but because she has lived among the Germans in the 20s. She has seen the collapse of the Weimar Republic. And, you know, she's only kicked out, you know, in the early 1930s. And she sees how that goes. Democracy was sort of, you know, too difficult an enterprise, you know, and, following the populist appeal of the Nazis was much easier and more attractive to many Germans.
It's funny. I have to interrupt because one of my, favorite lines in all movies, I think, encapsulates that American feeling of there's a difference between the government and the people. And it's in, I think it's in Full Metal Jacket, the Stanley Kubrick movie, in which one of the characters says that inside every Vietnamese, there's an American struggling to get out.
Yeah, wonderful. That captures exactly.
That really is exactly what Americans think. That really, that these governments are all imposed and that people would live just like us if they could. And I should say that this is a absolutely pervasive notion, and it has driven American foreign policy, I think, to some extent for a long time. And it is just a mistake. I don't know what to say. It's just a mistake. And it's funny because Americans think – I have this debate with my students a lot about whether democratic people make democratic governments or democratic governments make democratic people. And I have to say that the evidence is that democratic people make democratic governments. But my students just won't believe this. They don't think this is really true. So if we give them a bicameral legislature and a strong president, then, well, pretty soon they're going to be saluting the flag and everybody is going to be voting, for some Republican form of government. But it just really isn't. It just really isn't. So another thing I wanted to say, and I really liked in the book, and I always appreciate when books point out the enormous gaps in American historical memory, that there was considerable opposition to entering World War I. Americans have forgotten this. There was considerable opposition to entering World War II. Americans have completely forgotten this. In fact, I think you quote a poll which shows that the majority of Americans in the 1930s thought that entering World War I was a mistake.
Right.
It was our first Vietnam. Well, it was our first Vietnam, you know. I mean, people don't remember this at all because in the American mind, we're always on this moral crusade and we go in it with, one mind and one heart and we're going to strike the foe. But in fact, even the New Deal, I interviewed somebody about the New Deal, and there was absolutely vitriolic debate about the New Deal.
Yes.
Even while it was going on, people were extraordinarily angry about it. We look back on it in this kind of glowing light, oh, it was wonderful, and we all got together in the WPA, and they paid people to make music and poetry. It wasn't like that at all.
I think the hatred and suspicion of that man in the White House.
Mm-hmm. is exactly right, and I think that your book does a really good job of pointing out how really it was that things then are like things now. People will say, for example, I'm sorry to go off on this tangent, but that Bush somehow drug us into the second Iraq War. Well, I was alive during the time, and I remember a lot of debate and a congressional vote, and lots of people on both sides of the aisle supporting it. And it wasn't just George Bush; it was a lot of us supporting it. And there was debate about it. Nobody got bamboozled. We decided to do this thing after basically trying to rip each other's throats out, and it was just like that before World War I and World War II, I think. So in that way, I think the book does a really nice job of showing these lacunae in American historical memory, ever such. So let's talk a little bit about the reception. A lot has been written about this, as you said, the reception of the Holocaust by the American cultural elite and Americans in general. And there's a kind of a well-known book, Beyond Belief, about this.
Yeah.
So why was it beyond belief when they got the reports?
Well, again, I think that there are so many, sources that come to, so many factors that come together here. I think that after 45, and not immediately, but, after a while, we talk about the Holocaust and it's like a phenomenon in our mind. Whereas at the time, it was single reports. Mm-hmm. About, this camp and that transportation and those events. I mean, the genocide starts with mass shootings, mm-hmm. which could easily have been misunderstood as just, part of the brutality of war, mm-hmm. right? Why single that one out? That's what happens during war, war crimes. So I think so many things come together. I mean, one thing, just sort of to get that out of the way, this is, so in terms of American history, this is the high tide of anti-Jewish sentiment in this country, mm-hmm. So I think that makes that shapes both the Roosevelt administration and then more specifically the Office of War Information strategy. There is a concern over a homegrown societal anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. And so they opt against using really the centrality of racism mm-hmm. In Nazi ideology, in theory and in practice, mm-hmm. the OWI opts against, you know, using that. So the story of, you know, the persecution of the Jews and then the murder of the Jews by the Germans gets misrepresented as part of two different stories. One is sort of the Nazi attack on religion. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a very revealing public opinion poll in November 38, right after the pogrom, you know, the Kristallnacht, where something like 94% of Americans, which is like an extremely high number, right, show awareness of that event, of the pogrom, and condemn it, you know, express their outrage. Mm-hmm. And in the same poll, 96% of Americans condemn Nazi anti-Catholic policy, mm-hmm. you know. So then Jewish persecution is really misunderstood as an yeah. attack by the Nazis, not the Germans, the Nazis on religion, which again also affects the Germans, right, who are churchgoers, and thereby they also become the first victim of their own government. And then during the war, the Office of War Information has a deliberate policy against the use of atrocity stories. That's, mm-hmm. you know, sort of the World War I reverberates there. And there are all these, you know, important but very, for us, very painful to read quotes from officials where they'll say, you know, we won't use atrocity stories against the Jews because that will obscure the larger picture of Nazi brutality in occupied mm-hmm. Countries. You know, so in part it's a deliberate decision, you know, not to you know, not to use this information, and it's very tragic and painful for us to look at this because, you know, the Office of War Information will say, okay, so our goal is to characterize the nature of the enemy. You know, the nature of the enemy has to be understood and, you know, and told to the American people. And you think, yep. And what would really help Americans or anyone else to understand the nature of the enemy would be this murderous anti-Semitism and how important that was, you know, for Nazi ideology and policy and, you know, the realization of their racial dystopia, that they argue against it. And then I think for just, you know, for many Americans, you know, Ian Kershaw says the road to Auschwitz is built on hatred but paved with indifference. Mm-hmm. I think also after 45, I mean, American foreign policy really changes in nature. We become, you know, the leader of the free world. There is humanitarian intervention and so on. That was not really part of the menu in World War II and prior to World War II. Mm-hmm. I mean, the government had to fight off that label that, you know, the New Deal was a Jew deal. Mm-hmm. And there were, you know, there was a substantial minority, 30-40%, according to the, you know, to the polls at the time, that was susceptible to that propaganda that, you know, Roosevelt was susceptible to Jews as warmongers. You know, we're going to fight this war on behalf of the Jews. And then within the government, circle, you know, again, there are sort of vignettes that are very revealing. Jan Karski, who was, he was sort of one of the messengers, of the genocide. He was a Pole whom the Polish exile government sent to the British government and then later to the U.S. To report on what was going on in Poland and to report on the strength of the Polish underground. But he had actually been in a camp and he had seen, you know, mm-hmm. some of the worst. So he talks to people in London and then in Washington, and how Roosevelt and others react to him is very revealing. You know, mm-hmm. he has an interview with Felix Frankfurter, and Frankfurter responds by saying, I just can't believe this. I can't believe this. Mm-hmm. And the Polish ambassador is present at this interview. And he says, Felix, you can't tell this man that he is lying. You know, the authority of my government is behind him, and he was there. He has seen it with his own eyes. And Frankfurt just says, I'm not saying that Karski is lying. I'm just saying I can't believe this. Mm-hmm. Then there is another official who I think is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, but also works either for the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, or the Office of War Information. And he looks at, like many others, you know, he looks at the reports and he begins to understand the picture, you know. There is information published in the New York Times that, you know, a million Jews have been murdered in Europe in 1942, you know, and that there are plans to exterminate the rest of the European Jewry. And this man says, it's hard to say what to do about this. And I think we sort of have to take that seriously. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say what to do about this. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Roosevelt and others just opt for, okay, we have to win this war militarily. That's mm-hmm. what we can do about this. Mm-hmm. A poll in, I think this was also 38, shows that, you know, 2/3 of the American people were opposed to raising the quota, you know. Mm-hmm. Keep them out was... Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, I think you're exactly right about this. I think that the degree of it, I think it's very hard for modern Americans to understand the degree of anti-Semitism that was prevalent in the American mind in the 1930s, 40s, and even 50s. That it just we don't have it anymore, and it's largely a result of the reception of the Holocaust. And I think there's probably a really interesting book to be written if it hasn't already been written about the creation of the idea of the Holocaust, because if you read histories of the war prior to the sort of, I would even say before Davidovits and before the 1960s, that really the centrality of the Holocaust is never mentioned. It's almost as if it's not even known. And now it's simply become a trope. I mean, whenever you talk about the Nazi regime, you have to talk about the Holocaust. But prior to the 1960s, that just wasn't true at all. And I think that it's easy to condemn these people for choosing to put these military aims first. But on the other hand, how the United States, how people, you know, in my native Kansas would have responded to going to, you know, how it would have been spun. We're going to go and defeat the Germans for the Jews. And that just wouldn't have played very well.
Right.
It just would not have worked. And so it's easy to, I understand what they were doing. Let's talk a little bit in the few minutes that are left about what the American government and the American people thought should be done with the Germans after it was clear that they were going to lose once they started to make plans. There are a lot of myths about this as well, most of them revolving around the idea that we were going to turn Germany into a giant garden.
Right. Which, you know, I never quite saw the problem with that. That's a very interesting story. I mean, on the one hand, I think it has to be emphasized that the wartime planning proper in this country begins not only with Pearl Harbor, but even before Pearl Harbor, you know? So I think that the wartime planning in general, but increasingly also for post-war defeated Germany, was very thorough and very proper. But I devote a good section of my book to the rehabilitation of the Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Morgenthau, who for me in many ways is a hero, just as much as he is, you know, a villain in much of the German historiography. And I say in my book that I think this is almost tragic that, you know, the Nazi propaganda survives in this vilification. Mm-hmm. Of Morgenthau as the author of this pasteurization plan for Germany, you know, for the longest time in the post-war, you know, historiography. I think this is somewhat connected to what we were just talking about. Morgenthau is the one cabinet member who takes in and accepts the information, the incoming information of the genocide. And he sort of draws the right conclusion, and he does something about it. So one way of discrediting Morgenthau in the literature, both the German and the American literature to this day, is to say, well, he really wasn't an expert on this question. He should not have had any hand, you know, in even writing memoranda on German, you know, post-war treatment, because the experts of the war and State Department and, you know, the Advisory Commission were doing that. But Morgenthau, in fact, was an expert. Mm-hmm. On the German question, because his department had dealt, you know, with them since 1933. He was the one cabinet member that was really, very much involved in rescue operations, to the extent, you know, to which they were successful and sort of pushing back on the State Department. That showed a very callous indifference in that regard. And then, you know, he really did understand the Holocaust. So he was looking for a plan and for devising a strategy of fundamentally restructuring and reforming Germany. And I think out of that impulse, you know, to prevent World War III by fundamentally reorienting the Germans, not just, you know, as a state in terms of political institutions, but in terms of its political culture, mm-hmm. and general orientation. I think that was sort of the motivation behind this partial deindustrialization scheme, because that's really what the Morgenthau plan was. You know, mm-hmm. he understood, I think, because of his portfolio, because of, you know, the work that the Treasury Department did, he understood the close connection between industry, business, and the military effort in Germany, you know. Mm-hmm.
And what did Roosevelt think about this plan?
Well, I mean, I think that in terms of a general understanding of Germany and what was going on in the Third Reich, Morgenthau and Roosevelt shared this Vincitatis position, you know, the idea that there actually was a considerable level of popular support in Germany for different aspects of Nazi policy, and that there were deeper roots and antecedents to Nazism in German history and political culture. I think they shared this. And so Roosevelt was quite open to the Morgenthau plan, and there were some sort of practical aspects that also appealed to him. Neither one of those two men looked forward to a long occupation by the U.S. Army in Germany. You know, they wanted to bring the American troops back home as quickly as possible. So the and in terms of Allied, politics, that also really seemed to work out well. Morgenthau's plan seemed to work out well both for the British and for the Soviets.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this: since we're almost out of time, I'm interested in your opinion about it. It's not exactly dealt with in the book, but what did Germans today think about the Americans' role in defeating the Nazis and in the post-war settlement? What is the sort of general feeling? Just to turn the question around, we've talked a lot about what Americans think about Germans.
Right.
What do Germans think about Americans, especially in this particular episode?
I think that we go through various phases, you know, like you could write about various waves of, you know, looking at World War II and American policy towards Germany during the, you know, first West German and now unified, you know, German period. So I don't think it's very coherent. I think that there are many Germans, obviously, you know, well, not starting with my generation, I think even earlier than that, who did experience the German defeat as a liberation.
Mm-hmm.
But just recently, in the 1990s, there was a German rediscovery of a cherished post-war self-image as victims. Mm-hmm. You know, when the Germans first emerged from their rubble in 1945, they very much think of themselves as victims. Mm-hmm. You know, victims of the Nazi regime, victims of the Allied bombing. You know, victims of, you know, the betrayal by Hitler and mm-hmm. and so victims of the, you know, Soviets, of course, in particular, the Soviet post-war treatment. But I think that we saw a revival of that in the 90s with this attention. A couple of books come out that focused on Allied bombing of German cities. You know, that, and so that's where this is revived. But I think that you know, German history is a very positive and good example for internationalization of history. I think that German history is one of the most internationalized historiographies, and I think that's a very positive development, and I think that's a very liberating development, and I think that's also how many Germans see it.
Yeah, you know? Well, I'll just give my kind of two cents about this. The French, God love them, never miss an opportunity to thank the Americans for saving them in World War I and World War II. And then they never support the United States in anything.
Yeah.
The Germans never, ever thank us for saving them from the Nazis, but they support us most of the time. In our So I don't know exactly how that breaks, but it's always struck me as extraordinarily interesting, at least. I've always kind of wondered about it. Well, anyway, Michaela, I want to say thank you very much for being on the show. We've taken up a lot of your time today. Let me close with our traditional final question, and that is, what are you working on now? What's your next project?
Well, I'm working on three different things, and my hope is that they somehow will coalesce, you know, and become coherent, become one project, so that I don't, you know, fizzle out on this. A little while ago, I started working on a group of German intellectuals who worked as political journalists during the Third Reich, and then continue in that professional career in West Germany after the war. So that's one project, you know, how sort of which parts of their political and personal identity and belief system, you know, that they have to suppress, deny, revise, you know, these kind of things. What I'm actually writing right now is a little piece on American nationalism and patriotism, and I'm interested in two aspects in particular. One is sort of I want to recapture the variety of American patriotism. I think that because of recent events and the wars that we're involved in, a kind of militant chauvinistic patriotism dominates the picture. But I think that the range of expressions of love for this country is actually much wider, both historically and even at the present moment. But I also think that World War II and after 1945, it's sort of a dramatic shift happens in American nationalism, and that has something to do with a kind of militarization in our foreign policy. And then thirdly, I hope that the way I can bridge these different things is I'm interested and fascinated by this question of lessons learned and lessons drawn from World War II. I mean, this obviously has roots in this, you know, in this book. So I'm looking at different European, especially French and German intellectuals, and then Germans in general, what lessons they draw, you know, from World War II. And then what lessons are drawn in this country from World War II. And I think there are the more sort of foreign policy relevant ones, you know, the Munich analogy and the anti-appeasement and, you know, which maybe culminate all the way in the Bush doctrine of, you know, preemptive war and so on. And then there are very different lessons that are less operational in foreign policy terms, but that are also drawn by American, you know, intellectuals and, you know, the theologian Niebuhr, you know, Hannah Arendt, other people come to mind, who see even the Nazi German experience more as part of a sort of more, they see the Nazi German experience as something that has something important to tell us about Western civilization and the sort of fragility of Western democracy and, yeah.
From your mouth to God's ears, This is, I tell my students about the fragility of Western democracy all the time and how weirdly unusual it is in the world historical perspective. I don't think they generally realize that. Well, I hope that those three projects come together. And if they don't, I hope you write three books. And then you can be on the show three more times, at least.
Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah, that'd be great. Well, Michaela Hanscom-Moore, let me thank you for being on the show today. The book is Know Your Enemy, American Debate on Nazism, 1933 to 1945. It's a terrific book, and I urge everybody to go out and read it. Michaela, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Marshall.
All right. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Michaela Honecker about her new book, Know Your Enemy, American Debate on Nazism, 1933-1945. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week. Thank you.